From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for listening. I'm Sam Hudzik. Coming up, there are a lot of old buildings in New England that have been converted to new uses, including out-of-use town halls.
As you can see architecturally, the back half of the building used to be the town offices and was spun 90 degrees and moved to make room for the addition of this front part of the building.
Then we visit a Smith College historian who studies and teaches about the N-word and has an interesting connection to it. Her father is Richard Pryor.
My father really made public the fact that African Americans use the N-word with each other. He used the N-word in a way that was subversive and defiant.
Her father's view on the N-word evolved, and she's trying to teach a new generation how to talk about it without saying it. And we hear from singers hoping to land a big gig in Hartford before a Yard Goats baseball game. And we're going to check in with the late, great Charles Neville's son about his latest music. All that and a commentary from Grace Lynn just ahead on NEPR News Now. But first, we're still seeing the fallout of what could be the biggest political story in our region this year, the dramatic fall from power of Amherst Democrat Stan Rosenberg. The former president of the Massachusetts Senate resigned from the legislature after more than 30 years of service. His decision followed a critical ethics report and calls from state leaders for him to resign. Many of his constituents told us they are sad and disappointed he's leaving, though not all think it's the wrong move. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown reports.
Northampton resident Lena Fletcher, a UMass professor, was at an outside cafe when she heard about Rosenberg's plans to resign.
You know, my understanding of the things that he's done during his career is that he's been an amazing politician for our town and our county and our state. It does feel like a shame.
Rosenberg stepped down as Senate president in December. And now, after a five-month ethics investigation, Rosenberg's colleagues have accused him of failing to curb his husband, Brian Hefner's, abusive behavior towards legislators and others. Rosenberg was also criticized for allowing Hefner access to his official emails and calendar and failing to enforce a firewall between government business and his personal life.
You know, he's obviously has had poor judgment, but I think he's one of the most hardworking, diligent, caring politicians I've ever had the pleasure of experiencing.
Howard Sasson is a lawyer in Northampton. Had Rosenberg run again, Sasson says he would have voted for him.
Nobody is perfect, and I think that for someone to lose their job, I think it has to be really egregious, particularly when you weigh it against all the great things he's done.
Several Democratic leaders had called for Rosenberg to resign from the Senate, as did Governor Charlie Baker. The Ethics Committee did not recommend Rosenberg leave his job, though it did suggest he be barred from any leadership position for more than 2 years. For that reason, Sasson says he thinks Rosenberg's resignation is probably for the best. Former Minister Linda Michelle thought it was fair that Rosenberg lost the Senate presidency, given that he no longer had the trust of many of his colleagues.
I think that there are consequences to failure to live up to the full responsibility of one's role.
However, she did not think he should leave the Senate altogether. Neither did Helen McMillan, one of several constituents who had sympathy for Rosenberg as an unwitting partner to his spouse's behavior. After all, they pointed out, love makes people do unwise things.
I think he was kind of personally very naive and maybe got duped by this young guy who seems very charming and so made some bad decisions, but I don't think he'd make them again.
Of course, now no one will know for sure. For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
And we're going to have more from Karen in just a few minutes. Now, though, it's not unusual in New England to see sometimes centuries-old buildings renovated and made ready for another use today. There are plenty of old mills, factories, even churches that have been spruced up for a new purpose and have become museums, retail space, and condominiums. But what about old town halls? Just a few miles apart from each other in southern Berkshire County, two former government buildings are the focus of similar renewal efforts. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier tells us more.
West Stockbridge has about 1,300 residents, so the town's center is quite small. The old town hall has been a fixture on the village's main street since 1854. It's a simple-looking two-story wooden building with white clapboards and tall rectangular windows. Before being officially designated as the town hall early in the last century, this building served as a barbershop, library, and even a bank.
We actually have the vault that was pretty much home-built.
That's Bob Salerno showing off a relic of the building's past on the first floor. Many of the bookshelves are still there, too, along with some historic artifacts from the town's past. And Salerno of the West Stockbridge Historical Society continues the tour.
So the stairs date back to 1854. They're not fire compliant, of course, but they're original, so we're keeping these.
At the top of the old stairs is a small auditorium with old wooden floors, room for about 100 seats, and a small stage. Many of the town offices used to be up here, and it once even was used as a gym. After the West Stockbridge town offices moved out early this century, the town tried to sell it, but it had no takers. Salerno says there was concern this old building would be demolished, so some of the townspeople reformed the Dormant Historical Society, came up with a plan, and in 2009 made a bid.
We got the building for a buck, and when we did the deal with the selectmen, both sides laughed over who got the better deal.
And since then, through fundraising and grants, the Historical Society has sunk $500,000 into the old town hall, with a lot of money going toward much-needed structural repairs. There's still more work to do and another $500,000 to raise. In the end, Salerno says the downstairs could be used as meeting space and for things like art classes, with the upstairs continuing as performing arts space. He says it's been a long yet worthwhile journey to save a building important to West Stockbridge's history.
It's the center of the town. It is the showpiece of the town. It is the heart of the town.
And as one nonprofit continues to work on the former town hall in West Stockbridge, 5 miles down the road in Stockbridge, another is looking to do something similar.
It is a building that has evolved over time to serve the needs of the community. And as you can see architecturally, the back half of the building used to be the town offices and was spun 90 degrees and moved to make room for the addition of this front part of the building.
Pastor Brent Damro of the First Congregational Church of Stockbridge shows me around. The old town hall actually sits on the church's property, but the town and church have had a lease deal since the late 1830s. It's a large white building with tall columns holding up a gently peaked roof, flanked by pine trees. It hasn't been used for about a decade, and the town has struggled to find ways to reuse it. But one institution in Stockbridge is interested in doing just that.
A couple of years ago, a citizen in town brought this building to my attention and said, have you ever considered this for the museum's expansion needs?
That's Lori Norton Moffat, head of the Norman Rockwell Museum in town.
And it was like a light bulb going off because the civic function, the civic center that that building holds in our town is so related to Norman Rockwell's work.
She says the museum is short on space for preparing traveling exhibits, storing art and educational programs, and the old town hall could be just the place for these functions. The Rockwell Museum and the church have a 2-year deal to allow the museum to sort out a number of details, changing the building's zoning with the town and seeing if it's possible to raise enough money to renovate and modernize the building. Moffat says it'll cost somewhere in the millions to do that, but she thinks it's worth it for both the museum and the community.
I think it's an exciting potential future use for the town hall that brings vibrancy to the community and a beautiful location for these museum activities that we've outgrown space for here.
While it will continue to require a lot of effort and money, both of these buildings, important to the respective histories of each of their communities, stand a good chance at seeing their 200th birthdays in just a few decades. For New England Public Radio, I'm Adam Frenier.
This past February, students at Princeton University protested when a professor used the N-word in a class about hate speech. He ended up canceling the course. It's hardly the first time this epithet has sparked a debate over racial sensitivity, including last fall at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. One Smith historian has an interesting connection to the N-word and wants to help teachers address it better. Karen Brown has this report.
Most people in this country know exactly what I'm referring to when I say the N-word. If you don't, please Google it, because I will not be saying it in this piece. But even if you imagine the word in your head, there's a visceral difference between hearing the euphemism, the N-word, and hearing the slur itself.
There's all kinds of other words that mean black that maybe aren't even nice words, like pickaninny, you know, but I can say that right now. So what is rooted in the specific history of this specific word?
Elizabeth Storter Pryor has been thinking about the N-word for a long time, and she's in a unique position to do so. Not only is she a Smith College historian of race in America, she's also the child of a white Jewish mother and a black father who happened to be Richard Pryor. The iconic comedian who rose to fame in the 1970s was one of the first performers to pepper the N-word throughout his routines. In this one on how whites and blacks interact with the police, we've bleeped out the N-word and, well, a few other words, too.
Because the police live in your neighborhood, see? And you be knowing them as Officer Timpson. Hello, Officer Timpson. Going bowling tonight? F***ers don't know him like that. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over. Hey, officer, yes, glad to be of help. Be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license.
My father really made public the fact that African Americans use the N-word with each other. He used the N-word in a way that was subversive and defiant.
A lot of ain't scared. You know, like when the Martians landed, white folks got scared. I'm a, golly, I tell you, just a big old helicopter thing came down and landed. Jesus Christ. Nothing can scare after 400 years of this.
Elizabeth Pryor was about 7 years old when this comedy album came out. It was decades later, as a new professor at Smith, that she unexpectedly had to make her own decision on using the word publicly. A student in her Civil War history class quoted a joke from a movie.
They repeated a line from Blazing Saddles that uses both a disparaging word for people of Chinese descent and the N-word.
We'll give some land to the but we don't want the Irish.
I was like, oh, and I was looking around at this classroom of mine, which was mostly white students, but some African-American students, and myself, who's African-American. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa.
The next lecture, she told the class the N-word was off limits.
Nobody ever said it again, but we didn't really do, it was a missed opportunity. There was great intellectual work we could have been doing in the class, and we weren't doing it because I had censored the word.
That was the last time she taught a course about racism without addressing the N-word head-on. Now she tells her students on the first day of class they will read texts that include the slur, they will see it on PowerPoints, but they will not discuss the word until halfway through the course. That's when she teaches the N-word's historical journey from a label for slave to a demeaning epithet, and she lets students talk about their own interactions with the word.
So it really does take several weeks of the students doing group work together, having some difficult conversations about other topics before you can even get them to have this conversation with each other.
Although she's been teaching and writing about the N-word for almost a decade, she still gets nervous every semester before the first N-word lecture, as do her students.
The black students are terrified that I'm not going to take care of them, that I am going to allow white students to say whatever they need to for their intellectual process. The white students are terrified that they're going to put their foot in their mouths in ways that they can't even predict because racism is so subtle and so deep. They're afraid that they are going to inadvertently reveal like a dark thought.
And if it's this awkward in a class with a black historian who specializes in the N-word, it's no less confusing elsewhere on college campuses. Last fall, a white professor at Smith was removed from teaching an English class after reciting the N-word in a poem and then suggesting students who were upset leave the class. He later apologized in the student newspaper. The teacher did not respond to my emails, and the English department chair declined an interview. Another Smith professor, Kevin Quashie, who is black, wonders if the college could have matched the professor up with another instructor.
What gets lost when things happen, the incidents at Smith or incidents at Princeton, or there was one at UConn and so on, we missed the chance to try to pay attention to the specifics of the dynamics and for administrators to really be thoughtful and not panic and to say, how do we fix this for learning?
Quashi says the N-word is virtually impossible to avoid in the classes he teaches, black culture, literature, and music, including modern rap lyrics. But he will never ask a student to say it aloud. So if there's a book or song passage he wants the class to focus on,
if it has that word in it, I'll read that passage, and then I'll decide in the moment whether I'm going to say that word. And I have to admit, in the last 4 or 5 years, as we've been in this kind of climate of intensity, I don't say that word.
Elizabeth Pryor says one thing that could diffuse this tension is teaching about the word at a younger age. After all, most American teenagers have had to read Huck Finn, which uses the N-word 219 times.
I kind of expected my students to come to me by college to have already had these conversations, and they haven't.
This spring, Pryor will be giving workshops to middle and high school teachers on ways to broach the N-word in class without making students feel unsafe or excluded. She's also writing a book about the epithet, partly from her perspective as Richard Pryor's daughter. She says there are so many things she wishes she could ask her father, who died in 2005.
Was it always a given that you would say the N-word on stage? Did you think about what it would mean having white audiences who heard you describing the way black people spoke to each other? Was that frightening?
Richard Pryor famously changed his views on the N-word after a trip to Kenya, when he came to see the slur as more demeaning than comedic. Here he is on the album Live at the Sunset Strip.
And I was sitting in the hotel, and a voice said to me, he said, look around, what do you see? And I said, I see all colors of people doing everything. And the voice said, do you see any? I said, no. And I said, you know why? Because there aren't any. And it hit me like a shot, man. I started crying and I was sitting there. I said, yeah, I've been here 3 weeks. I haven't even said it. I haven't even thought it. And it made me say, oh my God, I've been wrong. I said, I ain't gonna never call another black man.
I remember he pulled me aside and told me he was never going to use the N-word again.
And to her knowledge, he never did. For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
Commentator Grace Lynn is a children's book author and illustrator. Before she took her 5-year-old to a local women's march in January, Lynn searched for a kid's book about the big march a year earlier. The only book Lynn found disappointed her.
The book was a shallow story of a girl with a pink hat, ignoring most of the political aspects of the march. And it was written by a man. Now, the author's probably a nice guy. Maybe he marched with his wife and daughter and was so moved by what he experienced that he felt there should be a book about it and thought, I'm a writer, I can write the book about this. And so he did. But while he might have had good intentions, his actions have a jarring impact. The purpose of the Women's March was to have women's voices be heard, to amplify women's viewpoints. Having a man publish the first children's book about it not only means that he's speaking for women, but he's also eliminated that possibility for a woman writer. Now, no woman can create that first book, nor can she reap the publicity benefits and the publishing power that doing so entails. His action of creating this book is the antithesis of his subject matter. Because I'm a voice for diversity, white writers often ask me if they can write outside of their race. Imagining other viewpoints is why I'm a writer, they tell me. Why can't I write about someone that doesn't look like me? And at this, I have to tell them they're asking the wrong question. Because, of course, a writer can write about whomever he or she wishes. When it comes to writing outside one's race, the question has never been, can I write this? No, the real question is, should I write this? Because sure, a man can write about the Women's March. He's already done it. But should he have? If a man sincerely believes in all that the Women's March was and is trying to accomplish, he would be truer to those beliefs by allowing a woman to write the first book about it. Likewise, if writers believe in racial equity in our writers' community, they would be truer to those beliefs by realizing that there are some stories that are better left for others to tell. At the Women's March, I was struck by the signs everyone carried. Some were witty, some were heartbreaking, and some were angry, but all seemed deeply felt. If that sincerity is genuine, we need to bring it past the marches and the decorative pins and into all aspects of our lives, especially when we choose what to write and what not to write.
Grace Lynn is the author and illustrator of many children's books, including the National Book Award finalist When the Sea Turns to Silver. She lives in Florence, Massachusetts. Hartford's minor league baseball team, the Yard Goats, is doing pretty well in this young season. A few games above 500, third in their division. Also performing well, the Yard Goats volunteer force of national anthem singers. New England Public Radio's Tema Silk attended a tryout for the musicians.
If you were to make it to every Yard Goats game this season and get there before the first pitch, you could hear 70 different renditions of the Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, say, can you see?
Henry Smith's could be one of them. He's a security guard, and he's come to Dunkin' Donuts Park to try out. Not on the field today, but in a glassed-in suite way above home plate. An acoustical paradise, it's not, but the view is great. Smith's no newcomer to performing. He's been a contestant on American Idol. But for plenty of people auditioning here, singing before thousands would be a first. 8-year-old Kayla Prelo looks remarkably calm as she waits to be called. Someone at her after-school program heard her sing and suggested she try out. I'm a singer, so I want to know how Kayla's going to find her starting note. She tells me in voice lessons they've been working on that.
We practiced what note because I always go on that note.
So how are you just going to know? You're not going to have a piano there. You're just going to do it?
I think it's G.
So can you sing it?
Oh, say. Like that.
Actually, it's an E. But what a set of pipes. Minutes later, it's Kayla's turn to go in. She and her parents are greeted by two men. Neither of them are musicians. Like the other handful of judges, they're part of the Yard Goat's front office staff. Judge Steve Given sets the scene for Kayla. Imagine a capacity crowd, 7,000 people. They're all getting to their seats. You can smell the popcorn in the air, the freshly mown grass.
The team is taking the field and we're ready to play ball. We just need you to perform the anthem to get us started, okay?
Kayla starts. Fight through the perilous fight? You try it. Our anthem's lyrics are killer. In another room, with a great view of third base, is Yard Goats general manager Mike Abramson. He says he's seen lots of people sing the anthem, and crowds really react differently to each performer.
So it's just getting the vibe that you know will really get the crowd behind the singer and have people enjoy the experience of it.
This is the Yard Goats' second season at Dunkin' Donuts Park. And the number of soloists, groups, even a saxophonist who signed up to audition is more than double last year's. 400 in all, many more than possibly needed. But at a Yard Goats game, it's not just the anthem that gets sung.
And whenever you're ready, you start. You belt it right out.
God bless America, land that I love.
Judge Abramson is listening to 6-year-old Natalie Malinowski. He's impressed she can sing on key, and he asks her, can she sing the anthem too? It's not in her repertoire. The night before the auditions, Henry Smith, the one on American Idol, waffled about trying out. He's not a Goats fan. He's never even been to a game. But if he gets the chance to sing... For New England Public Radio, I'm Tema Silk.
Excellent job.
Okay, we're not done with local musicians. The great Charles Neville of the New Orleans-based Neville Brothers died in April at the age of 79 at his home in Huntington, Massachusetts. In a blog post on NEPR.net, our jazz host Tom Reaney called Neville a wonderfully warm and soulful presence. Well, his son Khalif is poised to continue the family tradition. He's 21 and recently released his second CD. Before his father's death, Khalif Neville spoke with New England Public Radio's Kari and Jerry.
Although he's been mostly raised in the hills of Huntington, Massachusetts, where his mother Kristen's family is from, Khalif Neville is very proud of the fact that he was born in the Crescent City. And he says it seemed natural that he would gravitate towards music at a very early age, although he isn't quite sure why he didn't follow his father and take up the saxophone.
I don't know what happened. I imagine my dad would have liked me to play the saxophone, but maybe I just didn't sound good when he gave me one, so I ended up on the piano when I was about 4 years old and kind of worked my way into it. And then I think he started letting me at least sit in with him on gigs when I was in like early high school.
Did you take music lessons?
Yep, I had several teachers, though none for that long. So I'd say mostly it was my dad giving me the foundation, theoretically, and then I kind of fleshed out the technique for piano.
After going through what he calls a frustrating period in middle school, Khalif says he became more serious about music in the 10th grade. He joined the jazz band at the Pioneer Valley Performing Arts Charter School in South Hadley, Massachusetts. At age 18, Khalif recorded his first CD called Discerning the Transmutants. Which means what?
My best interpretation of it, since it was a word that I made up, is kind of the unknown and just the supernatural, maybe. I don't know. It's up to you.
It's an acoustic set of solo and duo performances featuring his father that included Charles's composition, African Eyes. Khalif Neville has just released his sophomore recording, Wishing, in which he deploys the electric keyboards and organ, along with a trio and his father on some tracks, including this new version of African Eyes. Not one to constrict himself to any one style or genre, Khalif says the album reflects his broader tastes, from hip-hop to other contemporary sounds.
Me and my little brother, Talon Neville, who's a drummer, we both listened to a good bit of electronic music, which my dad, for a while, just didn't regard as music at all, which hurt my feelings a little bit, but I can see how all of those electronic sounds would be a little jarring, but I think it's cool, and it's definitely different than jazz or any of the old school styles of music.
Do you consider yourself a jazz musician or?
So that's another thing my dad taught me that really sticks, and I'm glad it sticks, because in today's day and age with all the genres on iTunes and the radio and whatnot, it feels very sectioned off. But he told me that music is music and you should be able to play anything. So I'd say I'm a musician and I love jazz and I love playing it, but I can get into some other styles, and sometimes I do, and with my new record I tried to kind of fuse a little bit of the hip-hop and the funk with the jazz, and I think it came out pretty cool.
The album features mostly original compositions by father and son, and includes his take on a couple of standards linked to the city of his birth, like this version of Iko Iko.
A lot of those songs do have words, but the one thing about New Orleans music that I really appreciate is that the rhythm section is really strong. It's really about the beat in the New Orleans music as well as everything that goes on top of it, but I just wanted to see what would happen if I extracted the beat and then inserted the like instrumental stuff on top of it as opposed to the lyrics or whatever else it might be. And I'll try to add a little 21st century twist to it.
Khalif Neville performing on his new CD, Wishing. For New England Public Radio, I'm Kari Njiri.
you can hear more from our spring music series at nepr.net. Thanks so much for joining us. For more news from New England Public Radio and the seven other stations that make up the New England News Collaborative, head on over to nepr.net. We also have a great selection of podcasts to choose from, including Beacon Hill in 5, where host Carrie Healy talks to State House reporter Matt Murphy for a quick look at the week ahead in politics and government in Massachusetts. And remember, please, New England Public Radio is a listener-supported public media company, so all of this is made possible by contributions from you and other members of our community. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.